Case number 25-51 Evidence. Sanford v. Trevor Hadar's Unido et al. Mr. Scott Bessant in his capacity as Secretary of the Treasury et al. Mr. Joshi for the appellants, Mr. Henriks for the appellees.
Morning, counsel. Mr. Joshi, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Nandan Joshi for the appellants. Congress enacted Section 6103I of the Internal Revenue Code to limit law enforcement access to confidential taxpayer records. That provision generally requires prosecutors to obtain a court order to access information in a particular taxpayer's IRS filings. Here, however, the district court held that 6103I2 allowed the IRS to disclose millions of taxpayer addresses to ICE without a court order. That was error. I-2 is not designed to give law enforcement easy access to taxpayer addresses without a court order. It assumes that law enforcement already has the taxpayer's address and will provide it to the IRS to obtain access to third-party sources of information. So the way 6103I works is that there are a set of documents within the IRS that are independent of information the taxpayer submits to the IRS, for example, in their 1040 or in their W-7 application for an ITIN number. These might arise from an IRS investigation into a third party where they obtain information. They might arise from a police raid, for example. That's one of the examples the IRS gives in its manual, where the information comes from a third party, not voluntarily from the taxpayer.
I'm sorry, I just have some questions about how this works. Does it include when your bank sends in information about your interests,
if or bank
when
is,
your employer reports your income?
So if your bank or your employer sends in information about you, that would be protected information. That'd be taxpayer return information.
Even though it's sent in by, it's submitted by a
third party. It's by or on behalf of the taxpayer.
But in doing so, the employer shows its address or the bank shows its address, that's not protected information.
So it's
presumably in sending this in, the bank is going to reveal its own address or the employer will reveal its own address. That's not protected.
Yes, I don't believe that is not protected as to the individual taxpayer. It might be protected as to the bank. However, for example, if the information comes to the IRS involuntarily of the taxpayer, if it's seized in a police raid for, say, the police raid of a business on a RICO case, somehow those the business records end up at the IRS. Some other law enforcement agency, if it knows of that, can use I-2 to get access to those records if it follows the procedures set out in I-2. Those are not
all of those records, including, say, they have copies of the W-2s for.
Yeah, that's the IRS's position. I don't know that it's been litigated, but that's the IRS's position. 6103 distinguishes between taxpayer return information and other types of return information.
It's crystal clear distinction for me.
Yeah, well, the underlying purpose when it was enacted in 76 was to encourage people, taxpayers, to voluntarily participate in the tax system. There is, of course, penalties for not participating in the tax system, but Congress said, in the wake of the Nixon scandal, said that's not sufficient. We want to preserve the integrity of the tax system by saying, when we force you, taxpayer, to submit this information, we're going to protect it as if that information were in your own home. And we're going to require a court order if law enforcement wants to get that information. And they have very various provisions for that. A1 is the primary one for criminal investigations. I-5 was enacted in 82. That says prosecutors have to get a court order to get the location of a fugitive from justice. And the IRS took the same position for a long time, saying law enforcement cannot use I-2 to get these types of addresses. Law enforcement must provide us the name and address of the taxpayer in order to get this third-party information if it exists for a particular taxpayer. The type of information you're talking about, many taxpayers may not even have the third-party information because they're not going to be investigated by the IRS or have independent sources of information. So what the IRS did here in response to the new administration's immigration agenda, say we're going to rethink what I-2 means. And now,
and they're basing their rethinking on I-2C, because I-2C yes. does have a carve out for tax
credit. It does.
So I mean, nobody disputes that if information is sought outside of taxpayer identity, and taxpayer identity is disclosed as it can be, as it must be actually right. under I-2C, then that taxpayer identity information can be used in the way that it's sought to be used here, as long as the request actually was accompanied by a request seeking other information.
I think that's basically right. The one caveat I would say is Congress's premise in allowing that type of disclosure, because initially it didn't allow that disclosure. In 76, it did not allow that disclosure.
And then in 78.
There was a technical fix in 78, because the theory is law enforcement already has this information. It doesn't make any sense for the IRS to then not be able to provide it back, simply because it came from taxpayer returns as opposed to some other source. And so we're going to have this technical fix where we're going to treat it as the type of information that can be disclosed without a court order in response to a valid request.
So can I just stop you there? So that's what what's the reason for the carve out in C for taxpayer identity? I mean, the way you just articulated it, as I understood it, was that, look, if somebody's asking for the information, they have it anyway. So why not just let it be turned over? But why? If they have the information anyway, then why turn it over? It doesn't tell me what's the affirmative interest in the carve out for a taxpayer identity, and what is it?
I think from the 78 legislative history, it was at least ambiguous. I mean, what you said made a lot of sense. Perhaps if they didn't enact that exception, the law would have been allowed the IRS to turn that information back over to the law enforcement agency that requested it. And what, Congress was concerned about taxpayer addresses, just like any other piece of information that a taxpayer might file in their tax return. And so they just wanted to clarify that this is, in this sort of situation, it's not, it doesn't raise the same privacy concerns and the same threats to.
I'm still not completely understanding. Why have the carve out for taxpayer identity, so that taxpayer identity not only can but must be turned over? If I'm understanding this correctly, right? Because under I-2C, when there's a request from an agency, the general bar against turning over, I forget the term, taxpayer return information,
right.
It doesn't apply to taxpayer identity.
Correct. The current formulation does not apply to taxpayer identity.
And why was it done that way? Why is there the carve out for taxpayer identity to allow taxpayer identity?
I think Congress might have been, they wanted to clarify the law. They also might have been less concerned about the privacy implications of the IRS confirming that the name and address that the law enforcement agency provided was in fact the name and address that was reflected in the tax returns that identified the taxpayer for purposes of this other type of information that was a legitimate purpose for under I-2, the third party information that law enforcement could see. So I would say it's just a technical fix to sort of streamline.
But a fix to what? I think you're assuming that I know more than I do. I think I'm not understanding what's it fixing. Why the affirmative? There must have been an affirmative interest on the part of Congress in assuring that the taxpayer identity information can be transferred from the IRS to taxpayer identity, if I said that right, can be transferred from the IRS to the requesting agency.
Sure.
Why?
Well, in the 76 law, that wasn't clear. Right. Taxpayer identity would have been taxpayer return information. It wasn't clear that the IRS could hand that back.
Exactly. So why did it need to be clear that it can be?
I mean, when the IRS violates or an IRS employee violates a provision of the of these protections, they're subject to criminal liability.
No, I get that. But why should they not be subject to criminal liability? I'm trying to understand what's the policy interest in making sure the taxpayer identity information can be turned over. Somebody must have thought there's a reason we need to make sure the taxpayer identity information can be turned over. What's the reason?
Well, once again, I think it was simply to ensure the IRS, when they do send that back, that information back, that it's not going to lead to any concerns about liability on the individuals who are at the employees who are doing that.
But why wouldn't we want them to be liable?
Because once again, if the law enforcement agency already has that information, there's less of a privacy concern of turning that back
over. But they might have wrong information. Suppose that they have an old address. The law enforcement has an old address, yeah. And they say, this is the name of the person. Here's the best address I have. And then it could be that the response would be, okay, well, that's the address you have. The IRS isn't supposed to correct that. They're not supposed to turn over the correct address. And yeah, you requested it with the wrong address or an old address, but there's no reason for a carve out for taxpayer identity if the policy determination was made that, look, that's okay. They've got the wrong address. Fine. They've got the wrong address. We're going to turn over all the other information that they've asked for. But the one thing we're not going to do is correct the address.
No, well, they shouldn't turn over all the information. If they can't match up the name and address, that's not a valid request.
No. Suppose I disagree with you on that. I mean, I just assume for present purposes that I don't think there's a burden on the IRS to make sure that the address that's in the request is actually the current correct address. Right. That may be an argument that's out there. It's unclear to me how forcefully that argument is being presented, but let's just suppose, and you might resist the assumption, but yeah. Let's just suppose that I don't agree with you on that, that I think, just for purposes of this question, let's suppose that there's a name and an address. It turns out to be an older address, but that's not enough to turn off the entire spigot, that you still have to turn over. And I'm not talking about a case in which only address information is being requested. I'm talking about a case in which the other things that everybody agree can be requested is being requested. That just because the address is an old one in the request, it doesn't mean that the IRS doesn't have to turn over everything. They turn over the other information that's being requested that you agree can be requested and needs to be turned over. Why was it the decision made that in the course of turning over that other information, the IRS also turns over the address?
So I don't know that a deliberate decision was made in that context.
But it definitely was, because that's the whole point of I2C, is that to make sure the taxpayer, as you rightly say, there was a question about whether taxpayer identity information could be turned over, and there was an affirmative decision made to make sure that it can be.
Right. And I think the concern that was before Congress's mind was that under the 76, in original 76 law, nothing could be turned back over that was taxpayer identity related. It was a technical fix to the law. It wasn't intended to create this loophole where a law enforcement agency could submit.
What was the problem that it was technically fixing?
Right.
All we have is the legislative history of the 78 report, and it mentions this problem that there was this, they were concerned that the IRS could not identify the material it was turning over with respect to the taxpayer's name and address.
So that the act of turning over things it can turn over would necessarily confirm the accuracy of the address. Is that makes sense, I guess.
Yes.
Because if we respond, then we're going, okay, yeah, we do have somebody on this.
I think the whole point is that this was a technical fix to sort of clean up the operation of the statute. It wasn't to create this loophole that allows law enforcement to, send over a spreadsheet of 1.3 million addresses and ask for updated addresses for all these taxpayers without any request to go after the types of information, third-party information, that I2 is designed to facilitate without having to go to court and get a court order. And so I take your point, Your Honors, that it doesn't seem like much, but that's the whole point. It was a technical fix to the statute in 78, and when in 82, when Congress wanted to allow prosecutors to look for the location of a fugitive. It enacted I-5. It didn't try to shoehorn that into I-2 and say you can do that, get that information without going to a court and meeting with strict standards.
Let me see if I can. I have to ask it my way. The statute literally does not support your position. I-2 says they can get disclosure of return information for use in criminal investigations. And we know from C that mailing address is part of the information that would be included in that term. That's just clear. There's nothing you can say to refute if that's all we're looking at. That is absolutely clear.
That's Your Honor, that's exactly our point. That's what the district court held. And the district court.
Wait. So that's straightforward. Now, I'm trying to understand one argument you're making is, well, it's kind of, as best I can understand, it's a little strange that in order to get that information, which the statute says they can, they have to give an address. Do you think that's really dispositive? Because as my colleague has said, it doesn't say what address they have to give. The government simply has to present whatever they wait, let me finish. Okay. So we're back down to the statute says, because of C, the mailing address is clearly return information. And I-2 clearly says the government can get return information for use in criminal investigations. What else is there apart from what you think is strange that you have to give an address to get an address? I hear your argument, and maybe it is strange. Is there anything else? The legislative history, I must say, I waded through it. First of all, we're skeptical of that kind of evidence, and I don't think it's powerful here. What else is it that gives your argument real weight other than this strange address in B and address in C? And that seems strange to you that you would require someone to give an address when they're seeking an address? Anything else?
Well, a few points, Your Honor. First of all, I don't in B, when it talks about the name and address, if you ask me what my name and address is, and I give you my name and I give you my childhood address, you would not think I was very honest. So it's not just any address. It has to be something that is the address of the taxpayer. That's so I think it's a little bit more than straight. It's incongruous. I agree that if you just look,
you got to have more of an argument than that. Okay, I hear you. Go ahead.
No, I understand. They shouldn't
overtly lie. You're saying, okay, let's accept that. But still, they can come in with the wrong address and be mistaken. And the statute doesn't appear to prohibit that. They could have a 2015 address. That's the best we have. And we have to give you an address. Here it is. It turns out it's 2015. It turns out IRS has the current information, and that's what they want. Now, how is that forbidden? Why? I'm not getting it.
So, well, we talked about B. There are a few other structural issues with...
No, they've got to follow the rest of the requirements under B. Okay.
Yeah.
But go ahead. What else?
So we have I-4, which talks about submitting taxpayer return information in court proceedings. And it does not carve out the taxpayer's address. I think for the reason is that Congress anticipated the law enforcement agency would already have the taxpayer.
Do you think there is a positive requirement of court support for this request? Is that one of your arguments, that you have to have a court order getting to be able to get this under the statute? Because again, I don't see that. Where do you think you're getting that? There are other provisions that do say that with respect to other matters. I don't see it with respect to return information in this particular provision. Where do you see it?
Well, definitely, certainly A1 and A5 talk about getting a court order to get taxpayer information. They are broader than I-2.
Right.
Admittedly, but that is the general premise of 6103I that sort of distinguishes between the protections.
It's surprising that wouldn't be in B if that was a requirement, court order. Seems to me requirements. And then they list the things that the statute assumes you've got to come with. And if court order was one of the things, I would expect it would be there if that's what Congress meant to say.
Right. And the reason 6103I2 does not have the court order requirement is that the expectation is that the information being requested is this third-party sourced information, not taxpayer address information. Or the alternative would be every filing a taxpayer makes throughout their life that to the IRS, every tax filing, all their addresses are free game for law enforcement. So if law enforcement says
in a criminal investigation, we're only talking about so it's not everything is open. In a situation where it's certifiably for use in a criminal investigation, that's the exception we're talking about.
Right. All 6103I is about, it's about criminal investigation.
That's not everything. That doesn't mean in every situation when someone comes in.
It means though every address the taxpayer has ever filed with the IRS becomes free game without a court order for criminal law enforcement to ask the IRS, give us this taxpayer's address history.
Okay.
And
if they have a criminal investigation purpose for seeking
it. Yes, if they have a criminal investigation purpose for seeking it, which isn't, I mean, all they have to do is, identify the statute and provide specific reasons for the information. If they're looking for current address, as ICE is doing here, that's easy to meet. They just say, we want to find the, it's always relevant to try to find the individual.
By the way, on that score, I understand that a lot of the underbrush here is about finding the individual. I actually didn't understand that that's the rationale that's being put forward in the MOU for getting the latest address, because I thought the rationale that's being put forward is not that we want to be able to find them so that we can do various things, including, you know, as you suppose, potentially have civil removal proceedings. But it was that knowing the current address would let you know whether the and then comparing that to the date of the removal order would let you know whether it's beyond 90 days.
Right.
Sure.
So that's the element of the offense. It's not actually finding the person in order to be able to implement criminal process. It's to prove a violation of the statute.
So a couple of points, Your Honor. First of all, the MOU, the very first paragraph talks about the desire to identify, exclude, and remove aliens.
I understand that. I mean, I'm not going to suggest that that's, you know, completely out of the picture. I guess it's sort of like saying that everything that's being done is informed by a priority of an administration, which I don't deny that point. But I'm just saying that as I understand it, and as the district court opinion says this, and I think some of the briefings says this, the primary stated reason for seeking address information here, it relates to an element of the offense, which is to show that it's beyond 90 days past the removal order date. And one thing that's interesting about the MOU is that it requires, as I understand it, there has to be a removal order and you have to disclose the particularities about that.
This MOU is limited to removal orders in that sense. However, the MOU talks about other federal criminal laws, just like the statute does. The IRS and the defendants here have taken the position that the MOU is sort of window dressing. If ICE came back tomorrow outside the MOU, they would still have to comply with the request for address information for other types of crimes. And I will say the statute, when it talks about the relevance of information, doesn't talk about element of the offense. So once again,
it doesn't. I take that point. But as I understand the theory that's being put forward here, that's the theory, is that the address information, current address information, bears on whether the person has overstayed 90 days beyond the date of the removal order.
I mean, that is what they've put forward. I think it's a... It seems perplexing that they could do that on a bulk basis, say that it's relevant in each case, depending on the information they get back. We don't have information about how ICE is actually...
Seems relevant. I mean, doesn't it? Isn't it?
Well, they would only get back the date, the address, and potentially the fiscal, the tax year.
For a tax year, right. So yes. If the removal order was 10 years ago, and it's the current tax year...
They should not get back where that information comes from. So it doesn't necessarily have to come from a 1040. I don't know if...
wherever the information comes from. If the idea is, suppose you have a situation in which the removal order was 10 years ago.
No.
And then the latest address, wherever it comes from, a return or wherever it comes from, is FY 2025 or tax year 2020, I'm speaking of fiscal years, not tax year, so 2025, then that would tell you something about whether the person's overstayed by beyond 90 days.
It's possible. We you know, once again, they could say we want this to locate the individual, and that would also be possible. Uh-huh. So, I mean, that's not really a limitation in this context. And, you know, ICE wears two hats, and they have a criminal hat and a civil hat, and they can achieve civil purposes wearing their criminal hat, which I think even the district court recognized but thought that was legitimate. I mean, they are allowed to use this information to contact a target and, you know, essentially propose a plea bargain that says if you turn yourself to port or turn yourself over to civil authorities, we won't prosecute.
Right.
That's wearing their criminal hat.
Which is kind of a natural part of the criminal process that often
correct occurs. Whether that, you know, is or is independently is or is not a permissible use of this information, the whole scheme depends on ICE being able to make a bulk request for, you know, for taxpayer updated taxpayer addresses instead of the sort of one-off request that ITU was historically used for by prosecutors to get the sort of third-party source information. It would go, you know,
just so I understand your argument. So on the one-off, the standard one-off request, what you view as standard request, and I think it has been historically the standard request, you don't dispute that if there's a standard request that involves someone who would be within the compass of 1253A for overstaying beyond 90 days, you don't dispute that if there's a standard request that encompasses other return information, you know, the kind of standard types of stuff that you see, and then the address, the current mailing address would have to be turned over, and the current mailing address could be used in exactly the same way that it's being sought and would be used in this situation, understanding that here that's the only thing that's being sought and it's being done in bulk.
Well, I guess I will go back to your earlier premise. I would read the address that has to be turned back over to be the same that was applied. I know Your Honor said that was the same that was used to apply, but that...
Okay, go ahead and finish that, because I have a question about that premise, but, and then we'll move on.
Yes, but otherwise, I would agree with Your Honor that the answer to the question is yes.
Okay, then on the premise, so if I'm understanding right, if your argument is right, that the address has to actually be the current mailing address, the address put forward in the request has to be the current mailing address. That's your position, right?
Yes.
If that's true, then if you have a situation in which it's a standard one-off request and it's for other return information that's directly relevant to a criminal prosecution, and the requester happens to not have the current mailing address, is your view that what Congress intended was that because the requester, who has an entirely legitimate law enforcement interest in seeking that information to prove, let's say, an element of the offense that's proven by not the return information, not the address information, but return information that they're seeking, that the IRS is duty bound to say, no, we can't give you that return information because you haven't given us the right mailing address?
The IRS has to, one caveat to that position, the I-2 allows for information on prior tax years. So it could be a plausible reading of the statute that if they're providing the address for a plausible tax year, a past tax year, they can provide a prior address. I think the better reading of the statute, though, is that not any old address would work. But even if the court rejects that and says an old address would work for a legitimate request for third-party information or I-2, in which case the IRS has to then provide the new current mailing address, that still doesn't justify this situation where they're seeking addresses only on a bulk basis without getting the sort of court, going through the court process that I-1 and I-5 would require for location information.
If they set up a computer, it would send in a request every minute because they're just going to be changing the name and address, so that in fact they were submitting 3,000 requests a day, but individually. Would that be okay?
No, I once again, I don't think the
so proper individual requests.
Well, I think they have set up a system. That's how they process the 1.3 million. I don't think that the issue turns on whether they do it in a single spreadsheet or a computerized one-off request for information.
So it doesn't matter. The volume really doesn't matter.
The volume doesn't, I mean, no, not legally, it doesn't matter if they did this for one or for several million. But when you allow them to, if you allow them to simply seek addresses, then that makes them able to seek it on a bulk basis or on a seriatim basis. When you limit I-2 to third-party sources of information, it necessarily requires them, when they're filling out the request, to identify, you know, why that particular piece of information is relevant to a criminal investigation. As a practical matter, that I think that forecloses the sort of bulk processing scheme that they have here.
Okay, I understand your point.
I'm over my time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal. Mr. Henricks.
Thank you, Your Honors. Aaron Henricks for the appellees. It may please the court. Plaintiffs here seek relief that would prevent the IRS from sharing information with DHS despite a statute that mandates such disclosure and despite both agencies' compliance with that statute. As a threshold matter, plaintiffs lack standing to maintain this suit. And regardless, the district court acted well within its discretion in denying the motion for preliminary injunction.
You started by saying the statute mandates it. Is it right that since the statute was enacted in 1978, this has never happened?
I believe it's correct that this particular request from this agency.
No, not from this agency, just a request for addresses alone has never been successful.
I'm not sure if a request for addresses alone has ever been attempted, but the...
They came up with the Selective Service. I thought that was a lot of the underbrush was it was about the Selective Service. So everybody knew that this was a possibility.
Right. As to the Selective Service example, no request was actually made through 6103 I-2 to find information on people who had failed to register.
It could be no request was made because nobody thought it was possible. I guess all I'm trying to nail down is that whether you're right or wrong about the what you see to be a statutory mandate, this dynamic has never played out before in the how many ever decades has passed from the time that this IPC was enacted.
Yeah, the IRS has never been forced to wrestle with whether this is mandated or not. The statute seems to imply that it's mandatory. And as to the Selective Service example, it wasn't that they didn't go forward because they thought it wasn't mandatory. And in fact, the memoranda on the Selective Service issue never made a clear conclusion. It said it's a difficult question, but never made a clear conclusion. Probably due to policy reasons, never actually sent over an official request to the IRS. So I'll begin with standing if there aren't other questions in the immediate. Yep.
I have some questions about how this works.
Okay.
Is that okay? So the argument here is that the MOU is just a reduplicating the statutory requirements. One of the things the MOU says in both Section 5 and 6 is that ICE will make these requests for information.
Correct.
Is ICE one of the statutorily authorized entities to make a request for information? I don't see them on the list in 2A.
It's a head of an agency, and as to these examples, the head of ICE, Todd Lyons, signed.
Is ICE an agency? I thought DHS was the agency. ICE is a component of an agency.
I believe pursuant to 6103, the head of an agency
that
ICE qualifies. Excuse me?
Is that missed somewhere? Is there a definition somewhere? I would have thought the head of the agency would be The agency here is DHS.
Correct. My understanding is that
it's pretty, the head it's of ICE. It's a pretty carefully enumerated list and doesn't include anybody involved in immigration enforcement other than if it was the criminal immigration enforcement, the deputy attorney general, or the FBI. And if the requests were coming from the Department of Homeland Security, or the head of the secretary, that would make sense. But you defining ICE as its own independent agency?
For purposes of getting information.
That's not the list. I mean, I don't know how you can, I don't understand your definition, how you're reading the statute. There's a reason here. It's here to make sure that this is done at a very high level.
Correct.
That's one of the protections, the very highest levels of an agency. And I thought ICE was part of the Department of Homeland Security agency. Is that right? Do I have the flowchart right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. They're not their own independent agency, nor is Customs and Border Enforcement. They're components is what they are of the Department. If I go to Department of Homeland Security, am I going to see ICE like under the lots of boxes and ICE will be under there somewhere?
Yes.
As part of the agency known as the Department of Homeland Security?
Yes.
So it doesn't qualify under the statute unless you've got a definition of agency. And I could have missed something, these tax laws. There's a lot going on here. Is there a definition or a case that says for purposes of this statute, ICE or one of its predecessors qualifies as an agency?
Candidly, Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question.
But it seems like there's a potential serious gap there because I think for obvious, when statutes say who may ask, there's usually a reason for that.
My understanding is that the government has, or the IRS has, gone through a comprehensive review of the legality of these requests and, in fact, rejected a previous request from IRS, from ICE, when the signing head of the, whoever signed the original request for data was not a high enough official. So the government's position is that Todd Lyons, as head of ICE, satisfies the requirement to receive
that. I understand that you all are doing it.
Right.
I mean, you all briefed the thing that this is the same as the statute. I'm just asking for what that legal argument was when I see Congress being very careful about who can make. These are serious requests for obvious reasons. I mean, not just for privacy interests, but this is the blood of the federal government is revenue. And you don't want to do things that are going to impinge on revenue collection for obvious reasons. And so it's strange to me that there is no argument in the brief, no analysis as to how ICE qualifies. Like when they had, they have like subunits, like the administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, but they don't have any subunits within DHS or one of its predecessors.
Your Honor, the government on this point, unfortunately, does not have a particular response to that, but I would maintain that the agency...
Does Section 5E, and this could just be... let me ask and start a question, might make this easy. Is this MOU modeled on... put aside the opening stuff about executive order, but all the operative terms, are they modeled on an IRS form that, when people want things, they fill out this form and they make all these promises about, because there's things here about procedures and things like that, that is that unique or is there some form that this was modeled on? Because that might solve some of my questions about how this works.
I believe that the MOU tracks the terms of 6103I2 and also in terms of the protection of the data once it's sent over is modeled after publication 1075 that describes the various procedures and policies in place to make sure that any disclosed information remains confidential.
The MOU is not with ICE, right? The MOU is DHS?
Correct. Yep.
Yes, but then...
And it's the Secretary of DHS that executed the MOU.
Correct.
Right.
But then said, here's how this is going to work. ICE will make the requests. That's 2A. ICE will make the requests. IRS will respond to requests from ICE. But the statute says the Secretary will respond to requests from and then lists the entities. So I don't think it matters who executed the MOU. The MOU said DHS isn't going to send in these requests. ICE is going to.
What's happening with the requests?
Currently?
Yeah, but like, well, how are the requests articulated?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by articulated.
Who is the ICE? Is it ICE that's sending a request as a component of, in their capacity as part of DHS because DHS, the Secretary of DHS has given ICE the authority to ask for a particular item? Or how is the a request under this MOU actually happening?
The request is authorized pursuant to the MOU between DHS and IRS, and following ICE, assuming a appropriate official signs over the request, ICE sends the request to the IRS. And then IRS sends, if it complies with the requirements, sends the information back to the back to ICE.
Okay, but is there any ambiguity in 2A? That upon receipt by the Secretary, this is Treasury for behalf of the IRS, which meets the requirements, a request from the head of any federal agency or inspector general, or in the case of the Department of Justice, lists some Department of Justice entities, director of FBI, administrator of DEA, any U.S. attorney, any special prosecutor appointed under, and there's a particular provision there, heads of criminal strike task force. So Congress has said where the request has to come from. This MOU says the request is not coming from the Secretary of DHS or anyone else on this list. The request is coming from ICE, and the IRS will respond to request from ICE, full stop.
The request is coming from ICE pursuant to authority granted by DHS.
Is there anything that's mentioned that lists sub-delegations like that?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
There is not. I mean, Congress knows how to say that. It'll say all that all the time when it wants to allow a delegation of authority further down the chain. And it seems like Congress right here was very careful not to do that. Then the releases to officers and employees of such agency who are personally and directly engaged in preparation for a judicial proceeding, an investigation that could result in such a proceeding or grand jury. How is this personally and directly engaged in showing being made when you're getting requests for 1.28 million addresses?
The request was made for 1.28 million. As of now, only 47,000.
Right.
Even if...
How is that being... I'm just curious. There may be, I mean, I don't know. It's,
I mean, the individual... The sorry.
There's a form request that I can look
the
at.
The individual who is investigating the 1.28 million is a high-level assistant director, and it's at the earliest stages
of... That person is personally and directly engaged in the investigation.
Yes.
What does personally and directly mean here?
I mean... At this stage of, you know, the very beginning of a aggressive criminal investigation, for a crime like the willful overstaying of a final removal order, the beginning of that investigation may look like a large spreadsheet.
So, but I'm sorry. Sorry. I'm confusing things here. It's my fault. I'm talking about to whom the information is released. Right? That's where they're personally and directly engaged in. Right? So there has to be a showing that the information will be released only to officers, employees who are personally and directly engaged. Is there something in the MOU that does that, that ensures that when the information comes back, it only gets channeled to those involved in that individual's criminal investigation?
Yes. The, The.
Sorry, there's a lot in here. I could.
No, no worries.
Something.
In Section 6 of the MOU, it describes the duties and responsibilities of ICE, which include keeping that information exclusive to people who are involved in that criminal investigation.
But then E says ICE will use and redisclose the address information. And I'm just wondering take it out of this case. I just don't quite know how this is normally done and then how it's done here. Before all of this, when a request comes in, do those requests usually identify the individuals to whom the information will be released?
And here, I believe the information is being released.
I'm just asking a question about, is that normally, do they list like names of the agents? I'm not even talking about this case. Yeah. A year ago.
Right. Let's say.
I don't know what they look like. That's why it's hard to know.
Yeah, if a single U.S. attorney's office were making this request for a bank robbery, I imagine that it would be sent to the individuals investigating that particular bank robbery.
The U.S. attorney would send it to, and it would the request identify to whom it's going to?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Are there other MOUs with folks that are... I just don't
know. The MOU, I think, is a solution to a problem that may have occurred if you tried to do large scale criminal investigations with individual agents all requesting from individual IRS agents and the information
request.
Being spread.
Individual agents right, can't right. request.
But
so that's not
then, well, then sending, sorry, I'm sorry, sending up individual requests to the appropriate agency head to send over to IRS, which would involve perhaps a greater risk of diffusion of this confidential information. The MOU streamlines that approach.
No, I think the whole point is that's why I'm asking, I guess my assumption reading the statute, if you say we're complying with every provision of the statute would be the right person would send in the request, and a listed authorized person would send in the request, and would say what information they want, and its connection to proceedings, investigations, grand juries, and to whom the information should be disclosed. Right, the secretary shall disclose return information. Two. And so the request has to say to whom this information is going. And the only people it can go to are people who are personally and directly engaged in that, I assume in this case is investigations, or maybe it's proceedings too. I was assuming not grand juries, but you can tell me if I'm wrong. So that's what the statute says. So the only way the Secretary of Treasury would know to whom to release this information is the identification of the individuals. So a U.S. attorney situation would say, please release this information to AUSA X, AUSA Y, maybe FBI agent Z, because they are personally and directly engaged in this investigation proceeding grand jury. How does that happen here when someone sends in a $1.28 million?
My understanding is that the individual who sent out that request is personally and directly engaged in that investigation.
So the person who makes the request doesn't have to be personally and directly engaged. I think it would be a lot to imagine. I think personally and directly means something more than I'm the head of the agency. I don't think Congress was assuming here that...
No, I'm sorry.
The Attorney General was personally and directly engaged. So I'm assuming the head has to approve the request. That's why the list is here. And then they say... Don't bother sending it to me. I guess so much about paperwork. Send it directly to ABC.
I'm sorry.
What do these requests look like?
I think we're confused. I mean the individual who they're sending I'm not talking about the head of the agency request. I'm talking about the assistant director who is listed as the person who's personally involved. I believe his name is Jeffrey Williams in the reporting, but he is the individual that the information sent to.
So his name is on every single So when there was a request for $1.28 million, his name was the person listed as the person
yes.
whom the information should go, and he was personally and directly engaged in investigating 1.28 million people at that moment.
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, can I ask it? I think it's related to this. There's this implementation agreement that's referred to in the materials that's in the record, but not in the appendix.
Yeah, that's
Is some of this spelled out in the implementation agreement, how the mechanics of this work?
The implementation agreement is the kind of highly technical modes of data transfers. So, yes, I think that the implementation agreement outlines some of the finer details about how this works in practice. And I would just say, and I apologize for not having the exact details on this, the conversation reflects kind of a larger difficulty with this case in that it's a pre-enforcement preliminary injunction. So the record before the court is really the MOU, the statute, and what was before the district court. So it's difficult for the government at this stage to explain exactly how this is being enforced when the lawsuit is challenging pre-enforcement.
Well, yeah, I mean, these arguments weren't being made, but they're still four square in the statute. So
to the extent you're arguing the MOU is consistent with the statute, that's why I'm asking. That's the argument you've made. And it's, I'm not sure it's pre-enforced. You all are processing these things already. You told me about 4,000 you'd already turned over. So that's why the questions about what this looks like and how they're showing it doesn't seem like something the government can't know at this stage.
Right. Do we have an example in the record of an actual request and response under the MOU?
No.
Can you tell me again, just so I make sure I'm clear on it, what's your response to the appellant's claim, excuse me, that a court order is not necessary to get a mailing address under 6103.12? One of their claims is this can't be done without a court order.
I think that claim contradicts the plain text of 6103.I2. 6103.I2 mandates that pursuant to a non-tax criminal investigation, if a requesting agency sends over a valid request, that return information and a taxpayer's identity is sent over, there's no mention of a court order in that.
But you're saying provision. The other statutory references to which they are pointing are irrelevant. I think they're citing some other provisions.
Right, other provisions. So, for example, I believe 6103I5 refers to locating a fugitive. One, that occurs only when there's an outstanding arrest warrant for an individual. And 6103I5 allows a requesting agency to obtain far more information than 6103I2. So each of these provisions represents kind of the balance that Congress is putting out between law enforcement efficiency and the confidentiality of a taxpayer's information. There were different balances struck in I2 than there were in I5. I5, they deemed a court order necessary, and I2, they did not.
What do you think under I5 is the most useful information?
It's hard to say. You can get the...
Is it? I mean, is it that hard? I mean, it does seem to me that under I-5, the most useful information to locate a fugitive would be where they're located.
If they're being truthful with their returns in terms of their address, then maybe. But if not, then the employer's address might be more useful, or information about their bank may be more useful. I mean, it's hard to say exactly without knowing the specifics of that particular investigation.
And I also wonder with respect to I-5, is the theory about how the information is going to be used by DHS/ICE, is it that the location is to find the person, or is it that the location is relevant to establish the 90 days, or both?
I think it could be both. It may be...
Because one of them would apply in the general fugitive context, the other one would not.
Correct, but... Under at least investigation into the willful overstaying of removal order, the location is useful outside of its locating properties because of the elements of the crime being investigated.
Can I ask another question? That is, my name is not particularly common, but there's a lot of people that have pretty common names. So if John Smith, so if you get a request from, assume it comes from someone authorized to send it, for John Smith at 333 Constitution Avenue. And that's the latest address the requester had, but it's been a while. And you run the search and there has to be an awful lot of, and that's the only information they've given you, name and address. There has to be a lot of John Smiths with different addresses. How do you not mistakenly turn over to the law enforcement agency the wrong John Smith? Or if it comes in and you've got multiple responses, you just say we can't. Would that be a non-response? Then you can't respond.
I believe that, or I don't believe it is true that in order to get the information from the IRS, there has to be an exact match with a name, either a name and an address that they have on file. So for John Smith at 333, at some point, the IRS would have to see a John Smith who also put a 333 down as their address, or an exact match between John Smith and the ITIN number that they were using to file taxes. So,
but they're not providing an ITIN number, are they, when they request? I mean, that would definitely narrow things down.
I believe that there are terms under the request that you can get an exact match either for the name and address or the name and the ITIN number.
Right. I just wasn't under the understanding that they have the ITIN number from something else. That makes sense if you have an ITIN number. But if you don't, and you know, if it's not 33 Constitution Avenue, but it's a very large apartment building in New York City.
Well,
you end up with lots of John Smiths that either currently or previously name and address matches. That's one thing that seems a little worse than when someone just says, I've got a name and maybe outdated address and I'd like to get.
So a couple things. First, I don't know how many real overlaps there's going to be between specific apartment numbers and someone's name and address that they had handed over to the IRS. For the purposes of this information sharing agreement,
there's a lot of people filing a lot of tax returns over a lot of years. And if you have common names,
well,
Maria Flores.
Let's assume that there would be a ton of, let's call it, repeat names that are going to be overshared. The important part of the agreement is that they're being sent over for purposes of.
No, I don't want my name sent over if I'm not the right person that they were asking for. That's why I'm trying to understand how you can very easily imagine more than one John Smith having lived at some point in the records of the IRS, even in the same apartment, in the same large apartment building. But that's not the address. You know, they provide a stale address. You've got a more recent ad. You've got lots of more recent ad. I mean, you're just going to be. Well, I don't know how you protect people whose information shouldn't be turned.
I think we've been operating under the name and address sharing information that we're talking about. But in the reality under the sharing that's going on now is the unless DHS sends over name, address, immigration court case number, date of final removal, they're not getting anything from IRS. And so I get the
your records are only gonna, I'm assuming you don't have records that are going to have those last two things. And so what you're going to be trying to match to is,
but I'm sorry.
Name and address.
But IRS will not process the request for name and address unless they see name, address, immigration court case number, date of final removal order, statute that's being investigated, and specific reasons why the location's relevant. So
when you pull up a tax return that says John Smith X address, I'm assuming nothing on that tax return or all the other files you have on that person are going to have anything about an immigration proceeding. So I don't understand how that narrows down what your response is. So I understand what you're saying. I mean, you're complying with the other parts of the statute. They have to say what they're investigating inside the statute. I'm not disputing that. I'm just assuming they've done a proper request.
Yeah.
And you get lots of responses with that common name for that common address. Is that the end of it? Because you can't match it?
Assuming that the request has already gotten through the door with the multiple other requirements to make sure that we're the person we're talking about.
I mean, the person requesting has all that information, but all they've got is a name and an address. It's a super common name and a super common address. Because it sounds like you're searching all IRS files back for I don't know how many years. And so you're going to get 3 John Smiths at that address. What happens then?
If there are...
Or who at some point lived at that address is what I should say. I'm just wondering what protection is there for the taxpayer who is...
I mean,
not the immigration enforcement, John Smith.
The protection there is on, I guess, let's say that there are duplicates. I'm not sure if there's a specific protection against, oh, that we got 3 hits on this, so we're going to run it down further. I'm not sure about that. Mm-hmm. But there is protection that the information remains confidential the entire time that it's being used by ICE. And as soon as... it's no longer being used for a criminal investigation. They have duties to destroy or return it.
That address now, I'm going to have law enforcement breaking down my door.
I would assume not, because ICE would have.
But ICE will have all this return information about me because the search doesn't do anything to differentiate. I had thought if you had multiple returns, that would be we can't tell. We don't know whose information to turn over, but it sounds like your answer is if we've got multiple people with that name and that address at any point in their history, you get all their return information and you leave it to them to sort it out.
I am not representing that there's not some procedure for dealing with duplicates. I just don't know one way or the other at this point, but I
mean, that's almost inherent if they're giving... Assuming, and maybe they have the more recent address and you have an older one. I mean, it could be either way, but if assuming they're giving you the last known address to them and assuming that you have the more recent one, that's going to, I assume you're going back and all your, I don't know how back your files, how many years back your files go for, your records go for.
I think if there's an address hit and I mean, the statute says that if you send over the address, IRS will send over the address that they have on file that matches that name and address.
Okay.
Your Honor, if I may just give a factual clarification here, in terms of the way the IRS is processing these requests, the IRS is only responding and providing address information to ICE if there is either one of two things, either an exact hit on the ITIN and the name, or an exact match on the name and the address. And that's an exact match. That's not Brad for Bradley. That is an exact match on both ITIN, because in many cases, ICE actually does have the ITIN of these individuals. Mm-hmm. That's actually the majority of the addresses that have been provided is where there's an exact match on both the ITIN and the name. If there's not an ITIN provided, then the IRS would instead search by name and address. And it's only going to be if there's an exact match on both of those things that there would be.
But when you say exact match, sorry, thank you, that's helpful, but one is helpful to know about the ITIN, so that's a lot of them. I didn't know they would have those. And then 2, that name and that name has been associated with that address at some point in that taxpayer's history, or only if it's the top address.
That's correct. There would be an exact match, and it could be for a prior tax year. It wouldn't have to be the current year address. That's correct.
The concern that I'm wondering about.
Yes, Your Honor, understood.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that you're trying to help. Let's not have people just coming up to the podium and starting to speak without asking for the ability to do that, because that's not normally what we do here. But I appreciate that you're trying to be of assistance.
I see my time is up. If there are other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Do you know what the... Oh, I don't want to stop the line of questions.
I'm just glad I have an uncommon name.
I know the feeling.
My husband does not, so I don't know what's happening with his documents.
Do you know the purpose of I2C?
The purpose
of why was there this determination made that taxpayer identity is something that needs to be carved out and should be turned over when tax return information generally would not be? Why was that determination made in 1978?
The purpose, not to get into the minds of legislators back then, but the purpose that is kind of obvious from the terms of the statute is there's a balance between confidentiality and law enforcement efficiency. And in weighing that balance, the taxpayer identity fell on the side of law enforcement efficiency, unlike other types of taxpayer return information.
So your view is that ITC actually was affirmatively intended to make sure that the law enforcement agencies had, the requesting agency had a current address so that they could use the current address for criminal investigative purposes?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's the purpose to send over the current address, but to send over the address that the taxpayer had most recently sent to the IRS, the purpose of the carve out for that information is obviously to aid in the investigation of non-tax federal criminal violations.
Because the address might be germane to the criminal investigation.
Correct.
You don't think it was because, okay, because there's some allusion to legislative history, and it doesn't look like that snippet of legislative history relates to actually making sure the law enforcement agencies have the address so they can use it for criminal investigative purposes. Now, it may be that the upshot is still that can be done. I am not saying that it can't be done. I'm just saying that I guess I wasn't aware that the reason that I2C was enacted was specifically to make sure that the requesting agency has the address so they can use the address for criminal investigative purposes.
I mean, it's located in a section of the tax code that is for the purposes of aiding in non-tax federal criminal investigations or
right.
Proceedings.
So, in other words, you think it should be read that way because it's in this provision, and that's the best inference from the text alone. I was just wondering whether there's something we know about the way this text came about that would shed additional light on that, but may perhaps not.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, of course.
Sorry. This phrase personally and directly, do you know if there's anything in the statute, in a regulation, manual, something that defines, because this statute's been around quite some time, or case law, case law that defines what personally and directly means?
I don't know of any further guidance on the meaning of that phrase. I think it's pretty plain that it's someone who is,
I don't think it's all that plain.
It's someone who is investigating criminal violations.
Okay. That's all.
There's no further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel. Mr. Joshi, we'll give you 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll just make a few brief points. First, I would like to draw the court's attention to 6103M, simply because there are various provisions in there which show Congress is very concerned about disclosure of taxpayer address information.
So you said M is in?
Mary. Especially subsections.
Same Millette to make me feel good.
You asked about the implementation agreement. At the time, this case was before the district court. The implementation agreement was not in the record. It was still under seal. It has since been disclosed, and it has been posted in the docket in the Center for Taxpayer Rights Litigation before Judge Colicatelli. So that is public now. Okay. If you're interested in that. Counsel mentioned that the IRS requires an exact match of the address. That I don't think is either in the MOU or the implementation agreement. And I'll point to page 54 of the government's brief, where they say, even if the memorandum were rescinded tomorrow, the IRS would still be required by statute to provide address information to ICE upon receipt of a valid request. So the government's position is the MOU is sort of window dressing, but it's really the statute that's doing the work. And under their interpretation of the statute, they would disclose address information in bulk upon request. And so it's not just limited to orders of removal. statutes such as the failure to register, the reentry after removal, other criminal statutes. A lot of these criminal statutes, the difference between innocent conduct and non-criminal conduct and criminal conduct is a willfulness requirement. And they, you know, DHS or ICE or whoever's responsible for, you know, asking for this information doesn't have to prove to the IRS there's evidence of willfulness. They can, they will say, and the IRS won't question, we are doing this investigation for this, these types of crimes. And if that would be sufficient for them to get location information of taxpayers in bulk. So there's no real limiting principle if they're allowed to implement I-2 in the way that they have done, announced that they will do in the MOU. And I will say the other point about data errors, when there is the traditional situation where the prosecutor sends a one-off request to the IRS, there's communication back and forth. I'll point to our brief at page 40, which notes that up till this year, all of these requests have involved prosecutors seeking information under I-2. And when you have these sort of mass process requests that are not looked over by an individual, you do run the risk of some data errors. I'm out of time. If there's any other question, I will have it answered.
Yeah, we can't. The implementation document, you said it's in the record in that other case?
Yes.
I think we can just, you can just introduce it into the appellate record in this one.
I'm happy to follow that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.